Well, hi everyone. Thanks for turning out tonight on this autumnal evening. We've got a treat for you this evening. We've got a talk by Steve. Now, I'm going to have to read out the title of this talk because it's quite long and quite interesting. It's Proudhon's Pipe Dream and Other Fairy Tales, Scientific Socialism versus Utopian Socialism. Okay, so a good title. Steve has very kindly agreed to do this talk just today. And it should be really interesting because this is actually Steve's first talk. So it's always really nice to get somebody talking for the first time because, as we all know, no two socialists think alike, so we always get it's always good to get a different viewpoint. What we'll do, Steve is actually going to talk for round about 40 minutes. We'll then go straight into some discussion afterwards, comments and discussion, and then we'll play it by ear then. So we've got until 9 o'clock to get some good conversation in this evening. So without more ado, as they say, I will hand over to Steve.
Thank you, Richard. Can you hear me? Is that loud enough? Yeah, right. First off, I'll just say, I'm briefly going to talk about the utopian socialists, Fourier, Owen, Saint-Simon, and then Proudhon, maybe about 10 minutes. Labour time vouchers, I'm going to talk for about 10 minutes on that sort of utopian idea, and I'm going to conclude with about 10 minutes on the materialist conception of history, which is scientific socialism. Okay, I want to begin with what Engels said at Marx's graveside in Highgate Cemetery in 1883. This is a statement on scientific socialism and the materialist conception of history. Just as Darwin discovered the law of development of organic nature, so Marx discovered the law of development of human history. The simple fact, hitherto concealed by an overgrowth of ideology, that mankind must first of all eat, drink, have shelter and clothing before it can pursue politics, science, art, religion, etc. That therefore the production of the immediate material means, and consequently the degree of economic development attained by a given people or during a given epoch, formed the foundation upon which the state institutions, the legal conceptions, art, and even the ideas on religion of the people concerned have been evolved, and in the light of which they must therefore be explained, instead of vice versa, as had hitherto been the case. I think that's wonderful. Right, what is utopian? Well, the Oxford Dictionary defines utopia as an imagined perfect place or state of things. Utopian is defined as an idealistic reformer. The origin of the term comes from Sir Thomas More's novel, published in 1516, called Utopia. The word comes from the Greek, and More is making a pun on words utopus, which means no place, and utopus, which means good place. It depicts an Ireland society of equality, communal ownership of land, and no private property. Scientific socialists define certain types of socialism as utopian, where theorists write of imaginary ideal societies with elaborate designs and concepts. To scientific socialists, these ideas are not grounded in the material conditions of society. Scientific socialism is Marx's fusion of Hegelian dialectics, French socialism, and the political economy of David Ricardo. Its basis is the materialist conception of history. Proudhon is one such utopian socialist who is reputedly the father of anarchism, and I'll speak later about him. Let's look at three utopian socialists of the early capitalist period: Saint-Simon, Fourier and Robert Owen. Saint-Simon was a French aristocrat. His earliest works, known as the Geneva Letters, appeared in 1802. His utopian socialism can be described as a technocratic socialism based on production for use, societies led by industrialists, guided by science, based on meritocracy. But there would still be social hierarchy. Politics would be non-power politics, a traditional state would be abolished. Saint-Simon wrote, "Rule over men would be replaced by the administration of things." Saint-Simon had no conception of antagonisms between capital and labour. He believed that a Christian brotherhood of man would renew society. He even appealed to the King of France to build the new order. In 1843, in an article for the New Moral World, Engels described Saint-Simon's thought as lost in the clouds of unintelligible mysticism, and identified a serious flaw in that the distribution of produce was to be regulated, firstly, by the amount of work he had done, and secondly, the amount of talent he had displayed. Okay, Fourier. He was a travelling salesman. He described his occupation as serving the knavery of merchants, which is quite sweet. His first written work, Theory of the Four Movements, appeared in 1808. He advocated the elimination of competition among producers to stop the production of useless things, duplicates and luxuries, and the idea of work as labour and enjoyment, and that the concept of play should be part of work. Fourier believed poverty, not inequality, was the cause of disorder in society. Fourier is famous for his communities called phalansteres, which were like cooperative grand hotels of ideally 1,620 people living in four-level apartment complexes, but where the rich lived on the uppermost floors and the poorest on the ground. Engels writes that there is non-abolition of property, there are rich and poor, capitalists and working men. We have in practice the old competitive system upon an improved plan, a poor law bastille on more liberal principles. In the Dostoevsky novel The Possessed, Saint-Simonist and Fourierist are used as derogatory terms. Okay, all right. Robert Owen was a Welsh businessman who was manager and owner of a textile factory in New Lanark, Scotland. He had about 2,500 people working for him, and this included about 500 children. He is celebrated for his working and living conditions he created at New Lanark. Short working conditions, renovated housing for his workers, the first infant school for children in the country, clean and healthy working conditions, and there was a raising of the standards of the goods produced. The business was a viable commercial enterprise. It's quite an amazing true story of the Industrial Revolution and the early days of modern capitalism. In his writings, Owen advocated villages of cooperation, communities of 500 to 3,000 members. We can credit Owen with the first use of the term socialist in his cooperative magazine of 1827. Later in 1832 in London, Owen established the National Equitable Labour Exchange, a labour bazaar using a time-based currency, labour notes as a means of exchange. And I'll speak about them a little bit later. Engels, in Socialism, Utopian and Scientific, he wrote, "Socialism was no longer an accidental discovery of this or that ingenious brain, but the necessary outcome of the struggle between two historically developed classes, the proletariat and the bourgeoisie. Its task was no longer to manufacture a system of society as perfect as possible, but to examine the historico-economic succession of events from which these classes and their antagonism had of necessity sprung, and to discover in the economic conditions thus created the means of ending the conflict." The socialism of earlier days certainly criticised the existing capitalistic mode of production and its consequences, but it could not explain them, and therefore could not get the mastery of them. It could only simply reject them as bad. The more strongly this earlier socialism denounced the exploitations of the working class, inevitable under capitalism, the less able was it clearly to show in what this exploitation consisted and how it arose. Okay, just a quick word, I didn't mention this in the introduction, just a quick word about Ricardian socialism. It's a term applied to some English writers on political economy in the 1820s and 30s, like John Gray and John Francis Bray. They drew egalitarian conclusions from the labour theory of value that had been formulated by Adam Smith and further developed by David Ricardo. Adam Smith in 1776, The Wealth of Nations, wrote, "The real price of everything, what everything really costs to the man who wants to acquire it, is the toil and trouble acquiring it. What everything is really worth to the man who has acquired it and who wants to dispose of it or exchange it for something else is the toil and trouble which he can save to himself and which he can impose upon other people." Smith later makes a statement which can be viewed as a comment on the surplus value of a worker going to the capitalist. "The whole produce of labour does not always belong to the labourer. He must in most cases share it with the owner of the stock which employs him." David Ricardo, in his 1817 work, Principles of Political Economy and Taxation, develops the labour theory of value, where value of a product is proportional to how much labour was required to produce it, and also includes the labour required to produce the raw materials and the machinery in the productive process. He wrote, "The value of a commodity, or the quantity of any other commodity for which it will exchange, depends on the relative quantity of labour which is necessary for its production, and not on the greater or less compensation which is paid for that labour." Right, the title of my talk is Proudhon's Pipe Dream, so let's talk about Proudhon now. Why did Proudhon drink herbal tea? Because he thought proper tea was theft. Okay, yeah. It's not a great joke. I think it's all right. Serious now. Proudhon is seen as the father of anarchism, and he has delivered some very quotable sayings. For example, whoever lays his hand on me to govern me is an usurper and a tyrant, and I declare him my enemy. And it's a really long quote. I haven't actually quoted it all. To be governed is to be watched, inspected, spied upon, directed, law-driven, numbered, regulated, and ruled. They're great. George Woodcott, in his book on anarchist and libertarian ideas, titles his chapter on Proudhon as The Man of Paradox. Proudhon himself believed his contradictions were signs of vitality. But as we will see, his ideas are tangled up, utopian, impractical, unoriginal, anti-socialist, petty bourgeois and capitalist, and a long way from, say, the anarchist communism of Kropotkin. Proudhon's 1840 book, What is Property?, delivers the answer that it is theft. He believes that property springs from man's desire to free himself from the slavery of communism. This is a reference to the primitive communist stage of human development, described later by Marx and Engels. He sees property as incompatible with imminent justice, as it will lead to inequality. But he also distinguishes between property, which is capitalist property, drawing rent, interest and profit through ownership of the means of production, and possession, which is based on artisan or peasant occupancy of land and use of tools. He opposes common ownership and writes of self-governing producers with private ownership in association with other self-governing producers and exchanging the products of their labour in a free market of equals. Right, in itself, the statement property is theft is, well, I'm quoting here, indirectly self-denying statement relying on what is known as the fallacy of the stolen concept. Right, I'm sorry about that jargon. Let's put it another way. Theft presupposes rightly owned property. If there's no such thing as property, there can be no theft. The statement has an internal contradiction. Now, let's hear what Marx has to say about the statement. This is from his letter to Schweitzer in 1865, after Proudhon's death. The very title of the book indicates its shortcomings. The question is so badly formulated that it cannot be answered correctly. What Proudhon was actually dealing with was modern bourgeois property as it exists today. The upshot is, at best, that the bourgeois legal conceptions of theft apply equally well to the honest gains of the bourgeois himself, since theft as a forcible violation of property presupposes the existence of property. Proudhon entangled himself in all sorts of fantasies, obscure even to himself, about true bourgeois property. Marx just fights here again. It could have only been answered by a critical analysis of political economy, embracing the totality of these property relations, considering not their legal aspect as relations of volition, but their real form, that is, as relations of production. Why did he get so tangled up? Marx thinks that Proudhon is criticising with the eyes of a small French peasant, and he measures it with the standards he inherited from the socialists. And he also identifies that Proudhon imitates Kant's treatment of the antinomies. Well, a quick definition, antinomies in the philosophy of Kant, they are contradictions, thesis and antithesis, but they do not form a synthesis in the dialectical fashion, but are existing contradictions from man's attempts to perceive the nature of reality. So back to Proudhon. Marx thought Proudhon leaves us with a strong impression that to him, as to Kant, the resolution is something beyond the human understanding, i.e. something that remains obscure to him. He cannot resolve the contradictions he has regarding property. It is as if property is beyond human understanding. Proudhon saw his ideal in small-scale property ownership of self-employed peasants and artisans. He exalted the peasant life. Proudhon, like later anarchists and some leftists, idealised the peasantry and see them as a revolutionary force in development of society, human society. In the manifesto, Marx and Engels point out that the peasantry now fight against the bourgeoisie to save from extinction their existence as fractions of the middle class. They are therefore not revolutionary, but conservative. Nay, more, they are reactionary, for they try to roll back the wheel of history. This is not to say that the peasantry were not once a revolutionary class. The Protestant Reformation in Germany included the peasants' war led by Thomas Munzer, whose 8th article of confession under torture before execution states, all property should be held in common and should be distributed according to their needs as the occasion required. Any prince, count or lord who did not want to do this, after first being warned about it, should be beheaded or hanged. That's great, that. That's fantastic. He said that under confession, under torture. This is an important letter. Marx was in Brussels and Proudhon was in Paris, and Marx had written to Proudhon asking him to, you know, work with him. Proudhon replied, and I think it's a really important letter because actually it really states really what Proudhon thought about the transformation of society. He refers to Marx's phrase in his letter of "at the moment of action." Proudhon carries on to say, "Perhaps you are still of the mind that no reform is possible without a coup de main, what we used to call a revolution. That's completely abandoned it. We do not need it to succeed. We do not have to promote revolutionary action as a means to achieve social reform. To bring back society through an economic combination, the wealth that has left society by means of a different economic combination, via political economy, to turn the theory of property against property, I would therefore prefer to burn property slowly with a small fire than to give it a new strength by carrying out a St. Bartholomew's Night of the Proprietors." I mean, it's clear that Proudhon is opposed to a transformation of society. Marx tells Schweitzer that in the Philosophy of Poverty, Proudhon attempted to represent the system of economic categories dialectically. In place of Kant's antinomies, the Hegelian contradiction was introduced as a means of development. In a letter to Annenkov in 1846 about Proudhon's book, Marx refers to feeble Hegelianism, mystical causes, and his history proceeds in the misty realm of imagination and is above space and time. In short, it is not history, but trite Hegelian trash. Right, I'll look briefly at the poverty of philosophy, which is Marx's devastating critique of Proudhon's The Philosophy of Poverty. First off, Marx criticised Proudhon's theory of synthetic or constituted value. This value for Proudhon meant the value which is constituted by the Labour Time Incorporated, which, as we know from earlier, can be found in Adam Smith and is developed further by Ricardo. Proudhon claims that it is an original theory and is the basis for the future emancipation of the workers. But with Proudhon's starting point, no egalitarian consequences can be drawn from his Labour theory of value. Proudhon appears to be unaware of the English political economists in the 1820s and 30s who drew the equalitarian conclusions from the Ricardian theory of labour value. Now, I won't go into further detail, but Marx argued Proudhon mistakes the utopian interpretation of Ricardo's theory of value for the basis of a new science. Proudhon believes in the eternal ideas, categories and laws of bourgeois political economy. Amazingly, his dialectics postulates good and bad throughout history, and Marx asks, what is the good side of slavery? Proudhon proposed the establishment of a people's mutual credit bank, and this was incorporated in Paris in January 1849 with 27,000 members. Although the bank was stillborn and never came into operation and folded within 2 months. Proudhon believed that a reform of credit exchange would foster exchange of products amongst workers based on labour checks. The bank would provide free credit with a nominal interest rate to cover admin costs. The labour checks would be circulating exchange notes instead of money based on gold. Proudhon's bank would be funded by an income tax levied on rents, interest, debts and salaries. Operating a free market, the goods would be exchanged at cost value using a system of contract between a free association of workers. In that letter to Schweitzer, Marx writes that Proudhon has a misunderstanding of the basic elements of bourgeois political economy, namely of the relation between commodities and money. I just want to finish on this little section on Proudhon with the quote from Bakunin. Bakunin, the anarchist. "How ridiculous are the ideas of the individualists of the Jean-Jacques Rousseau school and of the Proudhonian mutualists who conceive society as the result of the free contract of individuals, absolutely independent of one another, and entering into mutual relations only because of the convention drawn up among them. As if these men had dropped from the skies, bringing with them speech, will, original thought, and as if they were alien to anything of the earth, that is, anything having social origin. Had society consisted of such absolutely independent individuals, there would have been no need, nor even the slightest possibility, of them entering into an association. Society itself would be non-existent, and those free individuals, not being able to live and function upon the earth, would have to wing their way back to the heavenly abode. That's great. Okay. Labour time vouchers. John Gray, in his work of 1831, The Social System, first set out in a systematic way the theory and practice of labour time and their exchange of labour certificates. We came across labour certificates with Robert Owen's Labour Bazaars, where he used a time-based currency of labour notes with denominations in hours. Now, are Owen's labour notes money? Are they similar to recording socialists like John Gray and his currency scheme and Proudhon schemes? Do the labour notes circulate or not circulate? What about Marx advocating labour certificates in the 1875 critique of the Gotha programme? So, labour time vouchers, are they utopian? Is it currency reform? Are the theories behind such things currency cranks? Marx in Grundrisse critiques Proudhon and John Gray's theories about money and circulating labour time vouchers as replacement money. He refers to them as time chitters. They focus on the monetary sphere as the root of all economic troubles. John Gray in The Social System actually explicitly states that a defective system of exchange is the root of all the problems in society. The time chits would be directly exchangeable with every other commodity. They would circulate. They would, in effect, be money. Commodity production, i.e. capitalism, would continue. The labour money would face devaluation like normal money. Holders of labour notes could bid up the prices of commodities to their old level. So the actual labour time would depart from the nominal labour time stated on the note. It is not possible to abolish money without abolishing commodity production, i.e. capitalism. The time chitters are proposing a commodity exchange in utopia. Labour time vouchers in a system of private ownership and production for sale are money. It is fundamentally unworkable. These utopian currency reformists want to alter the capitalist system of exchange only in order for their schemes to work. It would need a societal form antithetical to that of private exchange, i.e. socialised common ownership of the means of production. In Notebook 1, the chapter on money, Marx states the fundamental question as follows. Can the existing relations of production and the relations of distribution which correspond to them be revolutionised by a change in the instrument of circulation, in the organisation of circulation? Further question, can such a transformation of circulation be undertaken without touching the existing relations of production and the social relations which rest on them? In a contribution to the Critique of Political Economy, in the section on theories of the standard of money, Marx looks at John Gray again and sees that Gray assumes that commodities could be directly compared with one another as products of social labour. Labour time contained in commodities immediately social labour time, communal labour time, I paraphrase there. Gray is treating private labour as immediately social labour. He's moving towards socialised planning, which is antithetical to commodity production. Marx says it would indeed be impossible for a specific commodity, I paraphrase, sorry, to confront other commodities as the incarnation of universal labour and exchange value would not be turned into price, but neither would use value be turned into exchange value and the product into a commodity, and thus the very basis of bourgeois production would be abolished. Gray is not advocating the abolition of capitalism. Marx concludes, the fact that labour money is a pseudo-economic term, which denotes the pious wish to get rid of money, and together with money to get rid of exchange value, and with exchange value to get rid of the bourgeois mode of production, this fact, which remains concealed in Gray's work, and of which Gray himself was not aware. In Marx's Capital, Volume 1, he compares abolishing money without abolishing commodity production as one might just as well abolish the Pope while leaving Catholicism in existence. Also in Capital, Volume 1, Marx writes about Robert Owen's labour time vouchers. Owen's labour money is no more money than a theatre ticket is. Owen presupposes directly socialised labour, a form of production diametrically opposed to the production of commodities. The certificate of labour is merely evidence of the part taken by the individual in the common labour and of his claim to a certain portion of the common product which has been set aside for consumption. But Owen never made the mistake of presupposing the production of commodities, while at the same time, by juggling with money, trying to circumvent the necessary conditions of that form of production. In Capital Volume 2, Marx writes in Chapter 18, The Role of Money Capital. With collective production, money capital is completely dispensed with. The society distributes labour power and means of production between the various branches of history. There is no reason why the producers should not receive paper tokens permitting them to withdraw an amount corresponding to their labour time from the social consumption stocks. But these tokens are not money. They do not circulate. All right, let's have a look at the critique of the Gotha programme. This was a programme for the German Social Democratic Party, which was a Marxist party in the 1870s. And Marx was writing about the lower phase of communist society, socialist society, as it emerges from capitalist society. He wrote, accordingly, the individual producer receives back from society exactly what he gives to it. He receives a certificate from society that he has furnished such and such an amount of labour, and with this certificate, he draws from the social stock of means of consumption as much as costs the same amount of labour. Is this like Proudhon, Gray and the other time chitters? Marx says, labour no longer exists in an indirect fashion, but directly as a component part of total labour. I see this as we have planned production, different relations of production. It is in the context of socialised production. These labour certificates do not circulate like money. In a Proudhonist utopia or capitalist society, the exchange of equivalent exists in the average, but in Marx's account here, it is the exchange of equivalents in the individual case. The lower value will not hold, but the labour employed in the production of products will no longer take the form of a material quality possessed by them. The products of our hands will no longer have control over us. Andrew Kleiman wrote, an actual hour of labour performed will count directly as an hour of social labour performed, and the producer who works for an actual hour will be entitled to a socially average hour's worth of goods and services. This is what it means for labour to be directly social. Every individual hour is deemed by society to be equal to every other one. Labour time vouchers can be seen as just one way of allocating goods before total free access, i.e. from each according to their abilities to each according to their needs, when the springs of cooperative wealth flow more abundantly. We in the Socialist Party have never advocated any type of labour time vouchers. We are in agreement with the anarchist communist Peter Kropotkin and his ideas expressed in the pamphlet The Wages System, where he refutes any concept of labour time vouchers. It makes no sense trying to measure an individual's contribution to production when it is cooperative and social. If production was still individual, it would not be fair to ration a person's consumption by number of hours worked, because skills being used would have been acquired and benefited from previous society and earlier generations. The whole idea of labour time vouchers to regulate consumption would be to retain the wages system. Goods and services would have labour time prices and would be subject to a supply and demand, inflation, devaluation, therefore it would be a monetary system. Kropotkin concludes, a society that has seized upon all social wealth and has plainly announced that all have a right to this wealth, whatever may be the part that they have taken in creating it in the past, will be obliged to give up all ideas of wages, either in money or in labour notes. I want to say again that Proudhon is reputedly the father of anarchism, but definitely not the socialist or collectivist or communist anarchism of Bakunin or Kropotkin or Marx. Marx in 1872 wrote, all socialists understand this by anarchy. Once the aim of the proletarian movement, the abolition of classes has been attained, the state power which serves to keep the great productive majority under the yoke of an exploiting minority, small in numbers, disappears, and the governmental functions are transformed into simple administrative functions. At the conclusion of the Proudhon critique, The Poverty of Philosophy, Marx writes, there will be no more political power properly so-called, since political power is precisely the official expression of antagonism in civil society. Okay, speak about the materialist conception of history. The basis of scientific socialism is the materialist conception of history, which has also been called the production theory of history, or historical materialism, or even dialectical materialism. The origins of Marxist theory lie with dialectics of Hegel. A quick basic definition of dialectics, it's the art of the logical argument to arrive at the truth, i.e. a thesis is proposed, an antithesis is counter-proposed, and the synthesis is the result. And that's rather basic. First, let's go back to ancient Greece. The father of dialectics is Heraclitus. He believed in the law of the unity and conflict of opposites, that all things are in motion, fluid, in change. He stated everything flows, and no man ever steps in the same river twice. All phenomena in perpetual change is adopted by Hegel. Hegel's theory of eternal motion is the development of the eternal spirit, the zeitgeist. Ideas are the motor of history and the cause of conflict, war, revolution, which moves on the course of history. But this emphasis on ideas is idealism. It is based on the existence of metaphysical or supernatural forces. It idealizes and is the opposite of materialism. It is worth pointing out that the materialism evident in Hegel's master-slave dialectic in the phenomenology of the spirit, which influenced Marx. In the afterword to the German edition of Capital, Marx recognised that the mystification which the dialectic suffers in Hegel's hands by no means prevents him from being the first to present its general forms of motion in a comprehensive and conscious manner. With him, it is standing on its head. It must be inverted in order to discover the rational kernel within the mystical shell. I'm going to go through a few of Marx's early works now. We are coming closer to the end. In chapter 4 of The Holy Family, Marx writes of a dialectical relationship. Proletariat and wealth are opposites. As such, they form a single whole. The proletariat is compelled as proletariat to abolish itself and thereby its opposite. The condition for its existence, what makes it proletariat, i.e. private property. And that's beautiful. And that was written when Marx was only 26. In chapter 6 of The Holy Family, we get the first glimpses of the materialist conception of history. History does nothing. It possesses no immense wealth. It wages no battles. It is man, real living man, that does all that, that possesses and fights. History is not a person apart, using man as a means for its own particular aims. History is nothing but the activity of man pursuing his aims. Also in The Holy Family, ideas cannot carry out anything at all. In order to carry out ideas, men are needed who dispose of a certain practical force. Also, if man is shaped by his surroundings, his surroundings must be made human. If man is social by nature, he will develop his true nature only in society. These statements, I believe, also show that the materialist conception of history is not a rigid deterministic theory. The theses on Feuerbach are 11 succinct statements on materialism. Again, Marx shows that the materialist conception of history is not an economic deterministic theory. Marx writes in Theses 3, circumstances are changed by men. Human activity or self-changing can be conceived and rationally understood only as revolutionary practice. Marx is saying that all men are both products of circumstances and potential changers of circumstances. The dialectical relation between circumstances and activity must be grasped as revolutionary practice. The dynamism of Marx's philosophy is evident and is even more concrete in Theses 11. The philosophers have only interpreted the world in various ways. The point is to change it. Philosophy and political praxis. Man is not simply a product of material conditions. That would omit the subjective creative side of man's interaction with nature. In the 18th Brumaire of Louis Bonaparte, Marx writes that men make their own history, but they do not make it just as they please. They do not make it under circumstances chosen by themselves. The following statement, I think this is great, the following statement by Napoleon Bonaparte shows he had perceived partially the truth of the materialist conception of history. Napoleon, I suppose he said this on St. Helena, Mohammed's case was like mine. I found all the elements ready at hand to found an empire. Europe was weary of anarchy. They wanted to make an end of it. If I had not come, probably someone else would have done like me. A man is but a man, but often he can do much. Often he is a tinderbox in the midst of inflammable matter. His power is nothing if circumstances and public sentiment do not favour him. The German ideology contains a detailed account of the materialist conception of history. Real individuals, their activity, and the material conditions under which they live, both those which they find already existing and those produced by their activity. Also, the first fact to be established is the physical organisation of these individuals and their consequent relation to the rest of nature. And men distinguish themselves from animals as soon as they begin to produce their means of subsistence, producing their actual material life, a definite form of expressing their life, a definite mode of life. The nature of individuals thus depends on the material conditions determining their production. I think in conclusion, life is not determined by consciousness, but consciousness by life. Marx's letter to Annenkov about Proudhon's book contains several statements. Their material relations are the basis for all their relations. With the acquisition of new productive forces, men change their mode of production, and with the mode of production, all the economic relations, which are merely the relations necessary for this particular mode of production. In the Proudhon Critique of the Poverty of Philosophy, we find the handmill gives you society with the feudal lord, the steam mill, society with the industrial capitalist. At the conclusion to the book, Marx writes, "An oppressed class is the vital condition for every society founded on the antagonism of classes. Of all the instruments of production, the greatest productive power is the revolutionary class itself. Meanwhile, the antagonism between the proletariat and the bourgeoisie is a struggle of class against class, a struggle which, carried to its highest expression, is a total revolution." I'm going to look very briefly at their manifesto in relation to the materialist conception. It's just the first line. The history of all hitherto existing society is the history of class struggles. Now, this will not fit a materialist conception of history because the first stage of human society, primitive communism, was not a class society. The manifesto was written before Marx and Engels became aware of Morgan's anthropological work, Ancient Society, first published in 1877. The later edition of the manifesto was altered by Engels to read all written history has been a history of class struggles. The structural outline of the materialist conception was formed by 1848, but there is flexibility in the theory. It is not just a formula of technological determinism, but a tool for investigating what has happened in history and analysing historical events, and also as applying practice for the future. I should really close now. I hope you found it interesting. I have, illuminating and quite enjoyable. I've got one last statement of the materialist conception of history. It's found in the preface to a contribution to the Critique of Political Economy. I'll just read this first paragraph. "In the social production of their existence, men inevitably enter into definite relations which are independent of their will, namely relations of production appropriate to a given stage in the development of the material forces of production. The totality of these relations of production constitutes the economic structure of society, the real foundation on which arises a legal and political superstructure and to which correspond definite forms of social consciousness." I mean, I could carry on reading that, but I think you've had enough. I have. Thank you.